Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Larry Leese. On today's episode, we begin an all-new season of True Crime Never Sleeps. This season, we're diving into the Zodiac Killer. Excuse me. Give me your thoughts in the comment section below on all things Zodiac. And let me know who you think is the Zodiac Killer. And of course, if you think it's someone related to, Ted Cruz, let me know. Because hey, nobody really knows. But with that, let's dive into today's episode, shall we? In late 1968, the San Francisco Bay Area felt like a world of contradictions. On one hand, there was the lingering glow of the summer of love. The area still buzzed with flower children slipstreamed by acid rock and idealism. On the other, a growing unease threaded through suburban Vallejo, less than 40 miles northeast, where families clung to routine, even as tensions from the wider culture began to seep in. To understand how the Zodiac saga eventually took root, we need to peer into each corner of this landscape, social, political, geographic, and procedural, before the first gunshots even sounded. Only by grasping how people lived, how they moved, how they perceived risk, can we appreciate why, by the time whispers of a new terror circulated, communities felt both insulated and vulnerable all at once. When San Francisco's Summer of Love peaked in 1967, thousands of young people flooded into the height, chasing dreams of peace, psychedelia, and communal living. By the end of 1968, however, the honeymoon was fading. Neighborhood blocks, once strewn with daisies, gave way to impromptu homeless encampments. Some would refer to streets as shabby height. By late fall, as families moved out and rented rooms to rock bands or LSD dealers, a dry cleaning innovations plant on 9th Street reported occasional break-ins, a sign that the city's economic underpinnings were fraying. Concert venues such as the Fillmore West and Avalon Ballroom, a few blocks apart, continued to host psychedelic acts, but police presence at those shows had doubled compared to the summer of 67. Uniformed officers patrolled corners where Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane fans congregated, and undercover narcotics units posed as hippies to bust open-door weekends. The message was clear. The city no longer tolerated unregulated free-for-alls. As a result, some disenfranchised residents crossed the bay to Oakland or Berkeley. Plane tickets to L.A. grew scarce, but bus routes like Greyhound and Amtrak offered a more affordable escape for those chasing the next scene. By autumn 1968, San Francisco's homicide count hovered near 90. A number that in earlier years would have stunned municipal leaders. Instead, local columnists like Fred Graham chronicled murders, stabbings, and arterial shootings in almost the same breath as rock concert reviews. Police dailies began referencing neighborhoods by code, District 2 for Tenderloin, District 3 for the Marina, signaling that patrols needed a specialized approach. By early December, a rotating squad of 40 detectives handled everything from purse snatchings in Chinatown to armed robberies at North Beach's tobacco shops. Radio dispatchers in the city's emergency communications center sometimes answered up to 2,000 calls a day, fielding everything from traffic accidents on the Golden Gate Bridge to domestic disputes on Potrero Hill. For many Bay Area residents, these figures represented an uncomfortable shift. This was no longer a sleepy West Coast town, but a fast-growing metropolis contending with 1960s upheavals on a scale few other cities had ever seen. Hey friends, real talk for a second. How often do you think about your online privacy? If you're like most people, probably not enough. And I get it. We're all juggling a million tabs, hopping from app to app, and just trying to live our lives online. But here's the thing. Every time you connect to Wi-Fi, especially in public places like coffee shops, airports, hotels, Amtrak, and Greyhound, your personal data is exposed. Passwords, credit card numbers, your browsing history, it's all up for grabs. And that's where NordVPN comes in. It's like putting a secure encrypted tunnel around your internet connection. No one, not hackers, not advertisers, or serial killers, or even your internet service provider, can see what you're doing online. It's peace of mind and a single click. And yes, it's incredibly simple. You literally just hit connect and boom. Location is hidden. The data is encrypted and I can browse freely, safely, and anonymously. Plus, with servers in over 60 countries, you can access content from anywhere. Want to stream shows that are only available in Europe? Easy.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Want to watch sports blackouts or bypass censorship? Done. You can use NordVPN on up to 6 devices all at once. So your phone, laptop, tablet, even your smart TV can all be protected at the same time. And let's not forget, they have 24/7 support if you ever need help. I was even able to call them at 2 o'clock in the morning in Texas and actually got somebody that can help me walk me through this whole system. So they're ready to help you anytime you need it. And because you're listening to or watching right now, NordVPN has a special offer just for you. Head on over in the link in the description, and at checkout, get a huge discount on a 2-year plan plus a bonus gift. And best of all, it's risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. You've got nothing to lose. Protect your data, protect your privacy, take back control of your digital life with NordVPN, your first step to safer browsing. And now back to our episode. About 30 miles northeast of the fog-shrouded Golden Gate, Vallejo offers a different rhythm. In 1968, its population hovered around 70,000, large enough to have its own sprawling downtown, complete with a JCPenney, a Singer sewing machine shop, and a neon-lit Sambo's pancake house that served blueberry stacks for 35 cents. Excuse me. Mare Island Naval Shipyard closed in 1963, but shipwrights still lingered, tinkering on decommissioned vessels. Repair shops in East Vallejo specialized in replacing corroded hull plating, while Navajo street diners offered prime rib for under $4. Yeah, you can't get that anymore. Even so, economic tremors from the yard's closure had not entirely vanished. Some families depended on limited union jobs at local packing plants or distribution warehouses, and unemployment rates hovered slightly above the state average, around 5.7% by late 1968. Despite those pressures, community life in Vallejo felt reassuringly routine. On Friday nights, high school teens from Vallejo High took turns hosting sock hops at the Eagles Hall on Georgia Street, weaving through hits like Green Onions and Do You Love Me. Church potlucks at St. Vincent Ferrer, its stone facade framed by oaks planted decades earlier, drew large crowds. Casseroles, jello salads, and freshly bread lined the tables, with nuns in black habits bustling around to refill plates. Grocery shelves in the Glen Cove district stock Campbell's soup for 39 cents a can and Wonder Bread for 25 cents a loaf. On Sunday mornings, seasoned fishermen launch their small skiffs from the Vallejo Municipal Marina, navigating the gentle tides of San Pablo Bay in search of striped bass. Yet, beneath that everyday normalcy, subtle signs of unease sometimes bubbled. In late 1968, Vallejo City Council approved a modest budget increase for street lighting, as if the darkness itself required more illumination. The sign outside the Vallejo Times-Herald on Marin Street alternated headlines about high school football scores with warnings from the city manager. Residents urged to report suspicious activity after 10 p.m. Police Chief George Guthrie, a former Marine lieutenant, occasionally addressed Rotary Club lunches to build trust. He assured citizens that while citywide crime had risen 12% over the prior year, Vallejo remained safer than many Bay Area neighborhoods. His optimism stemmed from relatively low violent crime rates compared to San Francisco, but his unease lay in the rapid spread of BART planned routes and freeway expansions, both capable of channeling crime into once quiet towns. Half an hour's drive northeast along Highway 780, Benicia felt almost timeless. A small town of fewer than 8,000 residents, Benicia's Victorian-era homes, painted in pastel hues of mint, rose, and dusty blue, clustered around First Street, which boasted antique shops and narrow sidewalks. Since its tenure as California's state capital in 1853-54, Benicia had prided itself on a slower pace. Fishermen mended nets on the waterfront docks, families gathered at small park benches to feed pigeons under willow trees, and on Friday afternoon, school children from Benicia High in Letterman jackets rode the school bus to the Chuck E. Cheese's equivalent arcade near the developing Napa border. Locals often drove their Chevy Impalas to nearby Martinez for chain restaurants like Wiener Circle, where a chili dog cost 50 cents and fries came in paper cones. Water and hills defined Benicia's geography. Just east of the town center, the strait shimmered under midday sun, connecting the Susan Bay to the east with San Pablo Bay to the west. At low tide, oystermen collected clams and mussels from muddy flats that would later be rowed past by sailboats in search of open water. At night, when street lamps flickered on, fishermen in thick coats nosed their pickups past the barge docks, hauling fresh catch to local diners known for their clam chowder simmering in large pots. But by 1968, developers eyed Benicia's farmland for suburban sprawl. The state had finished widening I-780 through Carter's Beach, turning what used to be quiet country roads into routes for an increasing volume of commuter traffic. Some longtime residents worried that once outsiders moved in, the town's sense of community would slip away as surely as fog drifts from the bay. Just west of Vallejo, over the rolling hills dotted with vineyards, lay another world entirely, the Napa Valley. In late 1968, Napa had around 28,000 inhabitants, farming families, winery owners, and migrant workers who followed the bellwether of the grape harvest. By November, clusters of pickers, some from nearby Mexico, roamed rows of Chardonnay vines, snipping grapes into wire baskets that would be dumped into bins hauled off by trucks. Winemakers like Joseph Heitz and Robert Mondavi had already started naming wines that would become famous, such as Chardonnay, but at that year's pressing, the flow of purple juice remained largely a promise of profits to come. Tourists from the Bay Area occasionally drove up for weekend getaways, offering mineral water baths, and Main Street restaurants served 65 steak dinners for $5, complete with mashed potatoes and glazed carrots. Yet, while the winemaking economy offered seasonal jobs, it also reinforced a sense of separation. For many Napa residents, the Bay's cultural currents felt distant, like remote signals on an old radio. The solstice fog that swallowed Lake Berryessa by evening kept most visitors away. In local schools, Napa High, Calistoga Elementary, students only heard about Hyde Ashbury in history classes as if it were a faded postcard, not a living, throbbing scene. Instead, everyday worries centered on whether frost might damage that year's harvest, or whether the state's water commission would cut irrigation during California's drought of 66 to 68. That isolation gave Napa a certain composure. Duck hunters on concrete wore camouflage jackets as they stalked pheasants near the old Silver Soul Mine, oblivious to the protests across the bay. Across these counties, policing was fragmented. Vallejo's departments, with roughly 95 sworn officers, covered an area of 57 square miles, an area that included densely packed neighborhoods, light industrial zones, and the city's marina district. Officers like Roger Bud Devana doubled as traffic enforcement and patrol, switching from radar guns on Redwood Street to responding to 911 calls about domestic disputes. The department's detective bureau comprised about 6 investigators, each juggling burglary after burglary and a smattering of assaults. On most days, those detectives handled property crime reports, stolen television, shoplifting rings, and credit card fraud. Even so, Chief Guthrie had begun lobbying for funds to form a small criminal investigations unit that could specialize in violent offenses, a request that city council members viewed as premature. Yeah, that was probably bad thinking following all this mess. Vallejo's overall violent crime rate remained lower than Oakland or San Francisco. In Benicia, the town marshal's office, essentially a squad of 16 officers, handled everything from traffic citations near the bridge to occasional bar fights at Joe's Tavern. Marshal George Quinn, a World War II veteran, assigned patrols in 2 shifts, a morning crew that handled parking and minor disturbances, and an evening crew that monitored the waterfront and the few motels on Park Road. There was no dedicated detective unit if something serious happened. Suspects went to the Solano County Sheriff's Office in Fairfield. The route from Benicia to Fairfield took 20 minutes on a clear day, but inclement weather or fog rolling over the hills could slow that drive to nearly half an hour. And because Solano County's forensic resources consisted of a small fingerprint lab in the old county jail, specialized testing like ballistics required sending evidence to the State Department of Justice in Sacramento. A process that could take weeks. Napa County's sheriff's office was similarly lean, with fewer than 50 deputies patrolling 789 square miles of vineyards, rolling hills, and pockets of suburban sprawl. The office rotated assignments weekly. A deputy might work the Silverado Trail in the morning, respond to a DUI on Highway 29 in the afternoon, and help with a noise complaint at a winery event on Sunday. Forensics, when required, meant deputies would bag evidence in brown paper sacks and arrange for a courier pickup to the DOJ lab. That delay often frustrated investigators dealing with stolen firearms or liquor smuggling rings. At Napa Valley College's criminal justice night class, some students joked that DNA analysis was science fiction. True crime books on sale at local bookstores mentioned it only as a futuristic concept. The notion that investigators could one day extract genetic profiles from the tips of envelopes or cigarette butts lay years away. It's still crazy, honestly, to like look back and see how much has improved and where we're going in the future, which I think is a good sign that all these cold cases will eventually get solved. It might take a while, but I don't think you can really get away with murder or any other crime for that matter anymore. But with that, let's continue. To appreciate how communities existed before any dark wave washed ashore, we need to glimpse into the minute details of daily life. In Vallejo, neighborhoods such as Glen Cove and Villas, split-level homes built in the early 60s, offered families 3 bedrooms, a small yard, and central heating fueled by natural gas. A working father, perhaps a machinist at a fabrication shop, woke up at 6 a.m. to catch a bus into American Canyon, leaving his wife to prepare scrambled eggs for their 2 kids. Kids in Renault Little League practiced base running drills on weekends, clad in dusty baseball hats that read VHS in bold letters. By 7:30 p.m., most families gathered around black and white television sets, 5 channels total, for the local news. They'd watch Chief Anchor Bob Kearns on KPIX Channel 5 deliver brief segments on traffic collisions, followed by the National Bulletin. Richard Nixon's focus on getting American troops home from Vietnam, and Hubert Humphrey's struggle to unify the Democratic Party. Local commercials hawked breakfast cereal and bargain-priced tires, often featuring fuzzy puppets or smiling spokeswomen in pastel dresses. In Benicia, a typical Tuesday unfolded differently. Moms in housecoats might walk to the general store, Peter's Market, where they bought a loaf of bread for 25 cents and a slab of bacon for 99 cents. Children at Benicia Middle School listened to teachers drone on about the Transcontinental Railroad's history, occasionally giggling when a geography teacher mispronounced cities. On the outskirts, farmland dotted with rows of onions and lettuce. By 5 p.m., wind gusts off the, apologies for butchering this name, Carcanese Street would whip autumn leaves around First Street, funneling through storefronts that sold window panes and antifreeze. In the evening, citizens gathered at the Benicia Elks Lodge for potluck dinners, meatloaf, green beans, and cherry pie, while discussing crop yields and the slight rumor that Napa's new winery festival would draw unwanted crowds. Set against this was Napa Valley's labor cycle. By late November, fields around St. Helena and Uteville lay bare, awaiting the next year's planting. Seasonal workers, some traveling by pickup trucks glossy with corporate logos, move between vineyards, harvesting grapes under the watchful eye of vineyard managers. During harvest nights, crews snake through rows and headlamps, baskets in hand, plucking clusters of grapes that might end up as world-renowned Cabernet Sauvignon. Yeah, I know, I just butchered that. By 10 p.m., many pickers return to bunkhouses near Calistoga or rented rooms in cheap motels, their hands stained purple from grape juice. The deeper you went into Napa's wine country, the quieter life became. Wine-tasting reservations filled with travelers from L.A. or the growing Silicon Valley. But by midnight, the valley returned to stillness, punctuated only by frogs near irrigation canals and the occasional owl.
Excuse me.
Geography itself formed a barrier and an invitation. Vallejo's position on the western, at the western front or end of the bridge meant it served as a hub. Highways I-80 and I-780 funneled traffic towards Sacramento and the East Bay. A driver leaving Concord at 5 p.m. could slip onto I-680 north, cross the Benicia Martinez Bridge, and arrive in Vallejo by 6:15, if the commute spared them from bumper-to-bumper traffic. Ferries from San Francisco docked at Mare Island on weekdays and weekends alike, disgorging commuters in neat slacks and skirts. Outside rush hour, that route provided scenic views. Alcatraz Island's silhouette, the Golden Gate Bridge's towers peeking through breaks in the fog, and houseboats docked along Sausalito. Into this mix, Lake Herman Road carved a dark silhouette, a slender, two-lane blacktop flanked by eucalyptus groves and dense brush. It rose from a junction about 10 miles east of the Benicia Bridge, snaking northwest towards Napa's outskirts. In winter, fog settled into the valley like a suffocating blanket, and the single streetlight near a gravel turnout offered scant comfort. Locals called it Cougar Point, joking that if you parked there at night, a mountain lion might join you. The bay breeze funneled through creeks that trickled down the hills, making windshield wipers stutter at times, and at other times, making headlights beam through swirling mist as if searching for something unseen. Furthermore, the bay itself exerted its own metamorphic influence on weather patterns. On a raw December night, temperatures dipped into the mid-minus 40s, and bay winds off Richardson's Bay created wet gusts that slapped faces with moisture. Memories of a 1966 flood when the Carcanese Strait spilled over onto the waterfront lots still lingered among older residents in Benicia, who recalled 7 feet of water covering Main Street. Consequently, when night fell, most locals did not venture out past 9 p.m., unless absolutely necessary. Urban myths whispered about hitchhikers who jumped from passing semis on Highway 29, or about a pair of trespassers spooked by rustling brush near Lake Berryessa. In an age without 24-hour cable news, information moved more slowly and more deliberately. The San Francisco Chronicle, under editor Walter Murphy, printed major headlines in bold type on page one. Scores, stock market results, and the occasional political rally. Local crime stories tended to stay on pages three or four, sandwiched between classified ads for used refrigerators and wedding announcement photos. Paul Avery's crime column sometimes highlighted high-profile events, like a knife point robbery in North Beach or an arson in Richmond, but rarely delved into suburban concerns. Meanwhile, on KRSS 90.7 FM, a low-power station run out of Sonoma State, DJs played Rolling Stones and Sons of Champlin, interspersed with short news breaks. The student sit-ins at UC Berkeley delayed classes for one more day. Or, SF's crime rate edges up 5% over the last year. but that station's antenna covered a radius of only 15 miles. For many suburban listeners in Vallejo, Santa Rosa, it was static more often than signal. For many suburban listeners in Vallejo, Santa Rosa, Susan City, it was static more often than signal. Television took longer to reach distant towns. KPIX Channel 5's evening news broadcast was at 6 p.m. and offered segments on San Francisco politics, Oakland A's baseball, and once in a while bulletins about a major incident in Contra Costa County. But any mention of Vallejo specifically required a separate call to the bureau, rarely dispatched unless the story was sensational enough. If a home-cooked meal spilled grease on the Highway 80 and caught a passing diesel on fire, stations might scramble a camera crew from San Francisco to capture the blaze, but then leave Vallejo's local crime unmentioned. By contrast, Vallejo's own Times Herald ran a modest newsroom staffed by 10 reporters, most of whom covered school board meetings, city council budgets, and property tax hikes. On a Wednesday, you might open the paper to read that the high school choir had been invited to sing at Sacramento State Fair, hardly the birth of a serial killer narrative. That information vacuum meant rumor and word of mouth often filled the gaps. If a pair of teens claimed they saw headlights moving down Lake Herman Road, a friend might call home to inform parents, be home by dark. Church pastors delivered announcements during Sunday services, introducing a note about recent concerns over rural roads without specifying details. Farmers in southern Solano County might stop by a diner in American Canyon to warn others that some folks have reported strange shadows by the cedar trees, though those shadows often turned out to be deer. Similarly, hitchhikers trying to score a ride into Napa found themselves turned away more often. "Sorry, kid, don't want any trouble," truckers would say. In that sense, information traveled not at television speeds, but at coffee shop speeds, slow, sticky, and prone to inaccuracy. 1968 was a year of tumult. On the national stage, the Vietnam War dominated headlines. Nixon's rising popularity contrasted sharply with LBJ's waning approval. And the Tet Offensive earlier that year shocked many Americans into the war's grim realities. Locally, Bay Area college campuses turned into flashpoints. Berkeley's Plaza remained an epic center of student activism, with free speech movement veterans staging teach-ins and protests. By fall, Vietnam War protests at Stanford occasionally sparked scuffles with off-duty CHP officers. Even as those events unfolded, the lessons reached beyond campus gates. Valley Town sensed that sirens, once reserved for factory accidents, could soon wail for something far worse. The civil rights movement added another layer. In Oakland, the Black Panther Party held weekly free breakfast programs for children, their presence a direct challenge to local police. Reports reached surrounding counties, Solano, Napa, and Contra Costa, about armed Panthers patrolling neighborhoods to monitor officers' behavior. For some suburban families, this reality reinforced a shared anxiety. If tensions flared in urban centers, might they spill over into quieter towns? Vallejo's city council occasionally debated forming volunteer citizen patrols, but ultimately they lacked the funding and volunteer interest to make them effective. In Napa, local wine growers donated to political campaigns aimed at restricting protests near vineyard. They feared that radicals might target high-profile wineries, even though the valley's crime rate remained historically low. The 1968 presidential election further polarized communities. LBJ's Great Society agenda, Medicare, Medicaid, and War on Poverty, encountered pushback even among some affluent suburbs. In Contra Costa County's Walnut Creek, Republican voters gathered at the Civic Center to endorse Richard Nixon's Law and Order platform. They viewed Democratic challengers as soft on crime, a message that resonated when crime statistics ticked upward. Local newspapers regurgitated poll results, Nixon leading in East Bay by 5 points. Yet at the same time, anti-war sentiment ran deep. At a First Presbyterian Church forum in Fairfield, Vietnam vets spoke about battlefield horrors, a stark contrast to headlines about domestic crime. These conflicting messages, a yearning for order and a craving for justice, coexisted uneasily, shaping a backdrop of apprehension that would later color how residents interpreted any unsettling news. The Bay Area's teenage scene in 1968 blended rock music, civil rights, and a growing distrust of authority. At Vallejo High School, Students don Letterman jackets emblazoned with VHS, and Friday night football games in a makeshift stadium attracted about 3,000 fans. Yet a new underground culture emerged. A handful of seniors circulated anti-war pamphlets, urging classmates to skip school on days when draft notices arrived. In Benicia, a small contingent of juniors and seniors began hosting teach-ins about climate change and energy conservation, ideas barely registering with college professors back east. In Napa, high school seniors compiled a short-run mimeographed magazine, The Grape Leaf, featuring poetry, short stories, and sketches illustrating the tension between growing up and feeling adrift in an uncertain world. Meanwhile, South Vallejo youth gathered after school at the Vallejo Skating Rink, a former roller rink repurposed into a multi-purpose center that hosted dance contests and occasional talent shows. Parents dropped off kids in station wagons, blaring Elvis or The Who before parking across the street in Glen Cove Shopping Plaza. Skate guards patrolled with walkie-talkies, their fluorescent jackets catching the buzz of overhead lights. Teens bought soda for 25 cents. Can't do that anymore, even at Walmart. Joked about their first jobs at local McDonald's and whispered about the cooler, older kids who smoked Camel cigarettes behind dumpsters. That compact microcosm reflected a yearning for belonging, a pattern that, in retrospect, set the stage for how rumors and fear could travel rapidly once something truly alarming surfaced. In most of Solano County, a sense of confidence prevailed. Parents believed the children could run to the corner store after dusk without issue. Teens lingered at diners until late, playing jukebox hits and arguing politics. Couples snuck off to Lover's Lane along Lake Herman Road, confident that nothing bad ever happens here. At holiday festivals like Vallejo's Christmas Boat Parade, families packed floats with colored lights, sipping hot chocolate, while quality brass bands played White Christmas. Yet that confidence foreshadowed a shift. The notion that rural roads and suburban streets were about to be shaken by events that no one could yet imagine. Police training in 1968 lagged behind modern standards. In the Bay Area, patrol officers spent 2 weeks at the California Peace Officers Training Institute's basic course, covering subjects like criminal law, firearms handling, and patrol procedures before graduating to ride-alongs with veteran officers. By contrast, today's academy courses span 16 weeks and include instruction on forensic evidence, crisis intervention, and community policing philosophy. For Vallejo's recruits, instruction often substituted film reels from the mid-60s that featured black-and-white footage of chases and shootouts in Los Angeles, tactics that sometimes felt outdated for a city grappling with increasingly complex criminal activity. When responding to calls, officers relied on bulky Motorola radios, two-way, but often plagued by static in hilly areas. If a deputy needed backup at a remote location, they pressed a button on a shoulder mic and hoped someone heard. At night, if a lone officer patrolled Lake Herman Road or Skaggs Island Road, they might radio in at set intervals, 10 p.m., midnight, and 2 a.m., If they missed the check-in, dispatch sent another unit to investigate. Yet, because budgets were tight, deputies sometimes patrolled alone, then returned to a central dispatch station to file paperwork by dawn. Reports typed on manual typewriters, carbon copies supplied to the district attorney's office, forensic protocols were similarly rudimentary. A patrol sergeant might dust a car's interior for fingerprints, but fingerprint comparison involved experts in Sacramento manually matching impressions against thousands of cards. Blood spatter patterns, if noted at all, appeared in handwritten notes rather than photographed analysis. In short, when an unprecedented crime eventually broke the mold of routine policing, the system struggled to adapt swiftly.
Excuse me.
The region's highways did more than ferry cars. They carried anxiety. I-80, running east and west along the Carquinez Strait, connected San Francisco to Sacramento through Vallejo and Fairfield. A commuter leaving San Francisco at 5:30 p.m. could join a parade of brake lights along the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, inch past Pinole, and perhaps get bottled up near Cordelia. That gridlock bred frustration, sometimes erupting in minor fender benders or tempers flaring at on-ramp merges. For people in Benicia, the bridge's toll of 50 cents each was a small price for shorter commute times. though it also meant LA-bound semis hauled cattle and produce right past their backyards, rattling foundations at 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. with equal disregard. For many, isolation came not from distance, but from speed. A teenager in Napa could finish an 11 a.m. shift at a vineyard, hop into an old Chevy Blazer, speed down Highway 12 in 30 minutes, inhaling the scent of oak barrels at the Woodbridge tasting room on the way. Yet, if that same driver overshot a curve near the Pleasance Valley Road, they confronted thick fog that swallowed headlight beams, an isolating hush broke only by the drone of passing trucks. In a region where roads and freeways crisscrossed counties, that paradox meant communities felt both connected and alone. A fleeting sense of mutual dependency anchored them by prying distances between towns preserved pockets of anonymity for those wanting to remain unseen. Finally, it's crucial to highlight that law enforcement's and forensic capabilities were rudimentary by modern standards. Like we've, you know, mentioned a little bit before, latent prints were dusted carefully with brush and powder, then lifted on clear tape and affixed on the fingerprint cards for manual comparison. If a .22 casing was found, it was bagged and sent to the California Department of Justice's Firearms Laboratory in Sacramento for rifling analysis. Excuse me. Often a process that took several weeks. Blood samples, if collected, went into small glass vials. But analyzing blood type offered only a broad, non-definitive categorization. DNA profiling wouldn't arrive until the mid-80s. In 1968, authorities simply lacked tools to extract cellular material from envelopes, clothing, or cigarette butts. Magnetic tapes recorded 911 calls, but departments rarely archived every incident. And when they did, tapes overlapped and were erased after a month or two to save storage space. In short, the forensic gap meant that extraordinary measures, like retrieving partial fingerprints from damp paper, were nearly impossible. The code-breaking efforts of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit had yet to crystallize into formalizing profile techniques. And most detectives relied on interviewing suspects, checking alibis, and analyzing crime scene photos. If a victim left no witnesses, the trail often went cold. By December 1968, the Bay Area's layered mosaic, counterculture's decline, suburban's routine tension, economic cross-pressures, fragmented law enforcement, and limited forensics created an atmosphere of unspoken vulnerability. Families continued to gather around TV dinners, teenagers edged closer to the glow of jukeboxes at diners, and commuters debated the merits of new freeway expansions. Yet, beneath that veneer of normalcy, communities sensed that some invisible force threatened the fabric of daily life. Neighbors installed a few extra porch lights, drivers volunteered to escort hitchhikers to safer areas, and churches held candlelight vigils just in case. Those precautions, modest as they were, reflected a dawning realization. The world beyond the bay's glittering waters could be cold, dark, and unpredictable. That realization set the stage for episode 2, where we'll explore how that dormant tension transformed into something palpable, as rumblings of danger on rural roads gave way to frantic law enforcement mobilizations. For now, though, consider this. A culture once defined by kaleidoscopic dreams and suburban confidence stood on the brink of its darkest hours, not yet aware that shadows could conceal more than the night itself. And with that, that marks the end of episode 1. Join us next week for an all-new episode diving into the Zodiac killings. Let me know your thoughts on the Zodiac killings in the comments section below. Of course, give us a thumbs up if you like our videos, hit the subscribe button, and hit the bell notification button to be notified of our next episode. As always, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNN or hit the scan the QR code right there. And with that, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time. Take care.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.